This is ridiculous, okay? I'll go. Shit.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, we explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roque. I'm a writer, producer, and host in San Diego, California.
And it is a new year, John. This is our first official Cinephiles recording that's not a live show in 2023.
Yeah, and we're doing it in the middle of thunderstorms in both of our cities right now. So if you hear loud noises, that's what that is. So there you go.
And so while we're about to roll into a big director in our annual season of with our exploration of Quentin Tarantino, we thought it'd be a good idea to do something fun. And I can't think of very movies that are more fun than Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
I know. What an excellent choice, man. We were kicking some ideas back and forth, and you mentioned Ferris Bueller, and it's something we've certainly discussed a number of times in the years that we've been doing the show, and it just kind of worked out that, okay, let's do it. Let's have some fun here, and hopefully, because we've sent out our listener survey, right? So I hope people who are concerned about us not talking about enough comedies or 80s movies will maybe take a step back and go like, okay, fine. They talked about an 80s movie and a comedy movie right off the bat. So,
well, this is, I can't imagine a more 80s movie than Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
For so many reasons, yeah.
In some ways, like, is there a more important director for people of exactly our age
in high school? No, there's no more formative director, that's for sure, because of so many of his films, whether directed or written or produced by him, that influenced so many of us through our teen years into our 20s, as we were glimpsing adulthood, right? I mean, what do you got? The Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles.
Breakfast Club, of course.
Breakfast Club, which we did on the show.
Yep.
What's the one? Some Kind of Wonderful, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and then Home Alone being kind of like that.
Transition, yeah.
Yeah, transition place. Of course, that's Chris Columbus directed it, but he wrote it. So there's so much of John Hughes that I think has created, has formed so many of us in our lives.
Well, particularly because, like, this movie comes out in 86. Ferris is graduating high school in 86. I'm graduating high school in 86.
Right.
Like, this is this and Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and those, they were directly at me and at my life, you know?
Right.
Like, do I think John Hughes is one of the great directors of all time? No.
Right.
Do I think that it's a certain point in my life he was speaking to me more than any other director? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Very possible. Yeah. So I know, for me, the same thing. I mean, for me, it's like, I'm 2 years, you know, I'm just a couple of years behind you. So for me, it's like, oh, I know I'm Anthony Michael Hall in 16 Candles, or I sense I'm one of the kids in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I'm one of those kids on the bus, you know, at the end. So there's so much that I can connect to. And then as I'm getting older, I'm Eric Stoltz in Some Kind of Wonderful, having that attraction to that girl that you think is unattainable. And how the hell do I get her attention? And all of that, all the way into Home Alone, where you, oh, and even Uncle Buck. Let's not forget Uncle Buck. That as well. Like, that idea of having a crazy uncle who's going to take care of you and being mad at your parents and all of that. You're transitioning in around that time. So much of myself in his movies as well.
Absolutely. Okay. John, how'd you first come to this film?
I went to see it with a bunch of friends in high school, of course. I mean, this one, you know, you'd had 16 Candles, I think, before this one. I think you'd had Breakfast Club before this one. So it was like, okay, all right, what's the next thing? And you saw this trailer, and I don't remember if I knew Matthew Broderick. I don't remember if I'd seen, I'd seen War Games, I guess. I had not seen, though, what, Project X or whatever that. That's after this. So I guess my connection was seeing him in War Games. So I'm like, okay, this is cool. Let's see what we're going to get from this. And it seemed like such a fun, cool movie. And this idea of playing hooky or skipping out on school to go and these crazy adventures, the trailer absolutely sold it. So a bunch of us went to see it at the local theater in Dale City at the time. And I remember just sitting there being transfixed by this movie as he was lit. He was like a spirit animal. I wish I could be Ferris. I wish I could live the life I'm Cameron in this movie when I'm watching it at the time.
Oh, yeah. And it's my story is exactly the same. I went to see it with a bunch of my friends. I think it was at the theater in Center Fell. I'm not sure, but I totally remember it. And of course, like a lot of these other John Hughes films, this was in the VHS rotation. I watched it over and over and over again.
Yeah, absolutely. I was doing lines as I was watching it. And Lindley walked over and she's like, you know, I can hear you, right? You know that I, because I watch on headphones when she's working. And she walked over and she's like, for God's sakes, I mean, you're doing the whole movie for me. You might as well take the headphones off. So very fun.
I mean, it is one of those movies where I literally probably do know every line. Like, yeah, it just, I've seen it so many times. Here's a little bit of pre-production. So here's, this is one philosophical idea I find really interesting, is that John Hughes is started because he said, I want to do a movie about someone for whom life is easy. And that is like the opposite of all storytelling. All storytelling is about creating characters that have problems.
Right. Conflict. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's if you don't have conflict, if you don't have someone who has a problem, you got no story. And
how do I relate to you if you have no obstacles to overcome? It's great.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is, and Ferris Bueller, he really doesn't have problems.
Yeah.
You know? And then this is how it really came about, is that we were heading towards a writer's strike in 1985. Mm-hmm. And an executive goes up to John Hughes and goes, I want to make a movie with you. If we don't have a script in 3 weeks, that's when the strike's going to start. And then we can't make a movie. And John Hughes is known as one of the fastest writers in Hollywood history. Mm-hmm. I think he wrote Breakfast Club in 5 days or something like that. Wow. I mean, he's that kind of writer. So he goes home and writes this movie in 6 days.
Insane.
Crazy.
Yeah.
There is a rumor that this is based on a kid he grew up with on a street whose name is Edward McNally, who was chased by a dean because of his 27 days of absence.
Wow.
Whether or not that's true, I don't know. There were several actors considered, including John Cusack, including Anthony Michael Hall, who apparently turned it down.
Wow.
But John Hughes says he always wanted Matthew Broderick, that he really wrote it with Matthew Broderick in mind. He had seen him on Broadway. And I think, and we're now at the point we've done so many movies, I really can't remember, but I think this might be our first Matthew Broderick movie.
Yeah, maybe. I would think there's not that many that we could do from Matthew Broderick. So yeah, I guess this might be our first one, and arguably maybe his best one.
It's very possible. And he is, so I'll give him this littlest bit of bios just because I think he's an interesting person. Yeah. His parents are theater folks.
Yeah.
He does a couple of small plays, and then he finds himself in an off-Broadway production of a little play by Harvey Fierstein called Torch Song Trilogy.
Yeah. Harvey Fierstein.
Which becomes a huge sensation. And suddenly Matthew Broderick is someone everyone is after. And the next person who goes after him is a little known playwright named Neil Simon.
Yes. Is this for Biloxi Blues or what's this for?
Brighton Beach Memoirs to start.
Oh, Beach, right.
And he does this. It starts, which I didn't know, it starts at the Amundsen right here in Los Angeles. And then, because, these productions start out of town. Totally. And then it goes for its second out-of-town location to San Francisco at the Curran Theater, where I saw him in 1982.
Wow. You remember seeing him. Wow.
Yep. I have such a strong memory of going to see Brighton Beach Memoirs in the city. Mm-hmm. And it being one of the, I assume you've seen it or seen the movie probably.
Yeah.
It's so good. Man, Neil Simon, when he's good, he's just.
Look, as great as John Hughes is, Neil Simon is just 1 million times better. And the ability that he had to write so many incredible plays, so many funny situations, it's fantastic.
And that leads to him getting cast in, he wins the Tony Award when he goes to Broadway. And he's fantastic in the play. And it leads to War Games, which is 1983, which I loved. It's also the reason that my sister refused to get a computer until she was in her 20s. Because she's like, nope, that's all evil. Scared the crap out of her.
Right.
Which I get. Lady Hawk in 85.
Right. Lady Hawk. That was the other one I was trying to remember. That's right. Lady Hawk. Yeah.
With Rutger Hauer at his height. And unfortunately, it's funny. I watched that maybe 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Did not hold up.
That's an 80s film.
It's very 80s. And then we get to Ferris in 86.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you bring this stuff up because now as you talk about it, this is also right around the time where I'm opening the door in my mind to the possibility of acting, right? Because this is right when I'm like 11 or 12 at the time. And I remember Torch Song Trilogy and Harvey Fierstein. I remember reading about that. I remember, I must have read it in the Washington Post in the arts section, because that's what I would do starting around 10 or 11 years old. My dad and I would sit there on Sundays and split the paper up between ourselves and read about it. And I don't know why I didn't, maybe it occurred to me that Matthew was in, but I'd never remember that. But Harvey Fierstein, just that name, I always remember that name connected to Torch Song Trilogy. And of course, he was recently in Bros, had a very funny sequence in Bros. So seeing him, so hearing that as you talk about it, then I remember, I think I do remember Brighton Beach Memoirs being a play up there. I think Mercedes Rule was in that, as in that version of Brighton Beach Memoirs.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. So I just remember, like, that was the, I was beginning my awakening to pursuing arts as a career, as a life. And so being aware of those kinds of things as you're talking about it, I was aware. I wasn't lucky enough to go and see it as you were, but I certainly was aware of it from my place in my house.
It's funny, if Karen were on this show, she would be forced to tell one of her favorite theater stories, which I'll tell four because it's a good one, which is her parents would take her to Broadway shows. And frequently her dad would just read in the paper whatever the big Broadway show was, but didn't always read too many details. And so he took them to Torch Song Trilogy when Karen was, I think, 10 or 11.
Yeah.
And he was late. And so he dropped them off while he went to park. And at the end of the first act, you know, they look over at their two daughters and go, oh, what have we done? And Karen says it's one of the great experiences of her life, because she had this, you know, amazing play, and then spent the whole next, you know, hours driving back to New Jersey talking about those issues. I mean,
that's shout out to her parents for staying in the theater. Yep. Some other parents might walk on out because of the subject matter, and the fact that they stayed and were willing to have that conversation, I think that was great.
I have one more thing to say before we jump into the film. And it's funny, you know, we just did It's a Wonderful Life, which is a movie I absolutely adore. And I know that you do too. And I also said, as we were doing it, like, this is like the handbook to codependency, and don't do what George does, even though George is a hero.
Yeah.
I had the opposite reaction watching this movie. I adore this movie. I think it's great start to finish. Almost every moment I think is fantastic. And the more I think about Ferris Bueller, he's not a good person.
Well, yeah, we're going to have some battles over that, I think, as the film goes along. So it's going to be a fun episode for sure.
Well, and let's just jump right into it. We start, we hear some morning radio. We fade up on this house, which is John Hughes' most, this is really a love story to Chicago in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And one of the things he's upset about is they did have to shoot half of it in Los Angeles, and that this particular house is in Long Beach. And that kind of bummed him out. But we hear some voiceover about Ferris and, you know, what's wrong. And then we cut to our first shot of Matthew Broderick just on his side under the covers, looking right at camera with a dead look on his face. And we get to watch him con his parents that he is sick.
I get it.
No.
I have a test today.
No.
I have to take it. I want to go to a good college so I can have a fruitful life.
I always enjoyed this, and even more so watching it this time around, this, what you could get away with back in the 80s, that idea of clammy hands and the hurt stomach and seeing his parents dote on him as the way that, and I had such a crush on his mom, by the way, seeing them dote on him in that whole sequence is so fun. It's such a great dad and mom casting. Mm-hmm. Both of them absolutely fit the roles that they're doing in such different ways. You know what I'm saying? And you sense that this is not a loveless marriage, that both of them have a connection to each other and they love their child very much, much to his sister's chagrin.
Yeah. Well, and the way it's shot is perfect, which is that they're essentially looking into camera.
Yes.
Looking down at him. He's looking up at them. And it's what's so great about Matthew Broderick, and I think he's great, you know, beginning to end, is the ability to play this level of sort of, we all know it's bullshit.
Yeah. Right.
And yet have enough sincerity that we buy his parents buying it to some degree, you know?
Yeah.
Even though they really shouldn't.
Even though he tells us, worst performance of my career, and it still worked. I also think it was smart of Hughes to do it this way because we become Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
And that's what he really wants us to be. He wants us to connect to this character and maybe, like, well, it's my opinion. What I sense that, what I analyze that I think John Hughes is maybe showing us from the beginning is that we are Ferris. We can be Ferris. We can kind of not take things so seriously, not get so caught up in the pain and the sordidness of life and, you know, live vicariously through someone like this in a movie like this.
You know, it's funny, the other movie that we just did that I would never have connected to Ferris Bueller at all, but One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a movie about free spirits versus the institutions.
Sure.
And there's a thing of like, well, rebellion against the institution here.
Well, sure. One's trying to educate you, though, and another one is trying to maybe drug you up or incarcerate you to keep you out of society.
I don't know. I saw those shots of those classrooms at his high school. They're pretty terrible. I mean,
that's standard what I went. Those looked just like my high school.
Absolutely. And of course, like all good liars, Ferris Bueller is trying to convince them that he should go to school so that they will try to convince him that he should stay home. And as this is setting up, we get these in-shirt shots of a tapping foot and angry tapping fingers. And there we see Jeannie, Jennifer Grey.
The great Jennifer Grey.
Oh, fine. What's this? What's his problem?
He doesn't feel well.
Yeah, right. Dry that one out. You can fertilize the lawn.
There was a time, ladies and gentlemen, where Jennifer Grey was really like this, the thing that was going to happen, you know, and this is one of those first roles where you really see that this was going to be a dynamo of an actress. She is great throughout this movie, and it was fun to reacquaint myself with this film after so many years to see what she brings to this character. Because look, Matthew Broderick is the star of the film. How do you counter that energy in a different, interesting, and unique way that keeps the audience's attention and invested in her journey, even if you may see her as the bitter, frustrated sister? How many siblings have probably watched this film and identified with her more than Ferris Bueller? It's interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, she's not buying any of this.
No.
And she's can't believe that her parents are getting suckered in. And of course, while this is happening, Ferris is winking at her and, you know, showing
that. The plot. Yeah, give it away the plot. Yeah.
You're letting him stay home? I can't believe this. If I was bleeding out my eyes, you guys would make me go to school. This is so unfair.
We've now set up her character in one moment. We understand what her struggle is.
Yeah.
Even if Ferris always gets what he wants.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's all, I mean, this is what's so hard for me about doing comedies is there are all sorts of little things, little looks, little touches that I want to describe, but it would take us forever. Mm-hmm. But watching the interplay between Ferris and his parents and between Ferris and his sister, it's all great stuff.
Yeah, it lays the groundwork really quickly without any exposition. You lay the groundwork of the relationships between all four of these people very clearly. Jeannie is the jealous one. Her parents know she's the jealous one. And she acts out in jealousy because of their frustration. But also you could look at the, because of her frustration rather, at the whole situation with Ferris. But also you could look at this in such an interesting psychological way. There are many daughters and mothers who would probably relate to this idea of the mom favoring the male son over the female daughter, sure, even though they're of the same gender. There's that kind of thing that a lot of psychologists and sociologists have explored in numerous papers and books about this relationship between the mother and the daughter when a son is involved. So it's fascinating to see it in microcosm way, right at the beginning, these battle lines in essence being drawn.
Well, there's also the son that is apparently always able to manipulate his parents into getting almost everything he wants.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Now I'm not saying I know anybody like this.
Nor should you say that.
Exactly. I love like Matthew Broderick. He says, you know, call if you need anything. He does a little phone like ringy dingy. Like all that stuff is hilarious. And it's all coming from Matthew Broderick, by the way.
Oh, so smart. Plays the baby angle so well.
I love you, sweetie.
Call if you need us.
The parents walk out, and something that I didn't know about these two parents. Mm-hmm. Right around this time, they started dating.
Oh, for real? The book.
And that, yes. And that this is Lyman Ward and Sidney Pickett. And then they got married.
Wow.
And they were married for 6 years.
Oh, for six. Only for six.
Yeah.
Oh.
But Ferris Bueller's parents actually married each other after this shoot.
That's hilarious.
Jennifer Grey was, while they were shooting this scene, dating Matthew Broderick.
Yes, this I knew. This I knew, yes.
And then Ferris, once they're gone, turns the camera and says,
they bought it.
Now, one of the reasons that they knew that Matthew Broderick was the right person for this role was that Brighton Beach Memoirs is all him talking to the audience.
Right. Yeah. Breaking the fourth wall.
So they knew this was something he could do. By the way, the other thing is now he's going to talk to us a lot. He's going to talk right to camera. John Hughes, and I think this is really smart directing, made the decision to shoot this all near the end of the shoot so that they had had the whole shoot for Matthew Broderick to get used to how to do this.
Yeah, the camera. Interesting. Okay.
Incredible. One of the worst performances of my career, and they never doubted it for a second.
And then he opens up the shades and says,
how could I possibly be expected to handle school in a day like this?
Well, as someone who took a few days off in my senior year of high school, because I found out how many days I could miss, and I knew I could still maintain my grades, I absolutely understood this moment even more so after being a senior in high school.
The one day I never cut school, and the one day I did in my senior year, I got caught and sent to the principal.
You didn't do it right.
Nope, I mean, didn't do it right.
We would, it was me and Maurice and Jim. We would cut school. We would go to museums down in DC. We would go play tennis. We would do all kinds of things, just kind of do our own thing. And look, it didn't affect us. Each of us kind of walked our path. Jim is a very good a journalist over there in Virginia. And Maurice has been a city manager in a number of cities. So, you know, we just took some time and had some fun with ourselves because we understood that we didn't want to take life too seriously as seniors, man. Thank you, Ferris. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Very influential. Well, and right now he gives some
Steve
very
like Jamie he got caught. He got sent.
I know. Well, and right now Ferris is going to give you some good advice.
The key to faking out the parents is the clammy hands. It's a good nonspecific symptom. I'm a big believer in it.
I love the way Matthew Broderick talks to camera.
Yeah, me too. I think he's so good. So natural at it. Not a lot of people can. He's very natural at it.
And I love, too, that now we get text on the screen giving the bullet points of his lecture.
A lot of people will tell you that a good phony fever is a deadlock. But you get a nervous mother, you could wind up in a doctor's office. That's worse than school.
And we see doctor's office pop up and in red, and we see, you know, phony fever get crossed out.
Let me ask you something. Had we seen that before in film? The idea of graphics popping up on the screen in that way as a person is talking. I don't know if we'd ever seen anything like that.
I wonder if it's in Annie Hall.
Oh,
that would be a place that it might be.
Oh, maybe. You might have an excellent point there. Oh, I didn't think about that.
There's maybe. Certainly stuff. I mean, certainly he talks to camera and breaks the fourth wall in all sorts of ways.
Sure.
It's funny. That movie is one, you know, obviously we have some strong feelings about Woody Allen.
Yeah.
That movie is one that I've never quite liked as much as I find to be an interesting film. I'll put it that way.
Fascinating. Okay.
You fake a stomach cramp, and when you're bent over, moaning and wailing, you lick your palms. It's a little childish and stupid, but then so is high school.
I love the way Matthew Broderick walks down the hall.
Yeah.
There's just something so charming about him.
There's a confidence to him.
Yep.
Right? And it's such a great portrayal. Look, people, as an actor, when you're looking at something like this, it's not so easy to portray confidence without looking cocky or looking like you're putting it on or faking it. He has such a natural ease to his confidence, charm to his confidence, an unshakable just belief in himself that you can see that is the way he knows we're going to go with him. It's smart what Hughes does. He's walking away from us. Right.
Yep.
Or if he's walking to us, we're standing there and we're just like watching, just transfixed. So he knows we're going to go with him. Or he knows we're going to stop and watch him as he's coming towards us because he's worth paying attention to.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
That is the message of the movie.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And then we cut to him in the shower, all of which is really funny.
Oh, my God. Covering the hand covering the camera is genius. Once again, making you feel like you're an interactive part of the movie.
Well, and it shows a little piece of his character. He doesn't mind that you come into the shower with him. But just one sec. Hold on. I need a little privacy.
Yeah, eyes up here, buddy.
I do have a test today. That wasn't bullshit. It's on European socialism. I mean, really, what's the point? I'm not European. I don't plan on being European. So who gives a crap if they're socialists? They could be fascist anarchists. It still wouldn't change the fact that I don't own a car.
And what song does he sing as he's in the shower?
Is it Donkashane?
Does some Donkashane.
I recall Central Park in fall. How you tore your dress. What a mess, I confess.
This was all shot near the end of the shoot, as I said. So they already knew that's what they were doing for the parade. And so they peppered in all these Donkashanes throughout the whole film.
It's not that I condone fascism, or any ism for that matter. Isms, in my opinion, are not good. If a person should not believe in an ism, he should believe in himself.
This is great logic.
Wise words.
Great logic from the man. But you mentioned earlier he doesn't have a conflict. He does. He doesn't have a car. This is a big deal throughout the whole movie. If he had had a car, this is a completely different thing. A film, rather. So because he doesn't have a car, this is what prompts him to do what he does with Cameron. This is what prompts him to have the issues with Janie even a little bit, because Janie's the one who gets the car. He gets the computer. So just very interesting. So he does have some conflict in his life that he didn't get something that he wanted.
Yes. Yes. This rich kid did not get one thing that he wanted.
Oh, don't start that.
It's funny that I'm the one that's starting that.
Yeah, it is.
You would think that it would be reversed.
Why? I think I'm pretty sure if I had been rich or grown up rich, I'd have been pissed off I didn't get a car either, you know, and got a computer instead.
Sure. But your sympathies do not tend to be with the wealthy in general.
Yeah, but I like this guy.
He's unbelievably likable. Like, that's he is such a seductive figure. Like, I would want to hang out with Ferris Bueller too. It seems great.
I'm not a fan of Eat the Rich, but I don't mind taking a bite out of the rich. That's the fair point, I think.
I think that's fair.
Yes.
I quote John Lennon, "I don't believe in Beatles. I just believe in me." A good point there. After all, he was the walrus.
It's an interesting quote, right? Because that is from God, which is one of the best fucking songs that Lennon wrote post-Beatles. And it's Imagine, but from a dark, different place, you know, and when he's going through scream therapy and what have you. So I think it's a great song. And so him quoting that from that song is such an interesting choice. It gives more layers to him than you initially think he might have, you know.
And then we cut to Ben Stein.
An interesting cat for sure.
Adams.
Here.
Adam Lee.
Here.
Adamowski. Adamson.
Here.
So this is where he comes from, really.
Yes.
Where he actually comes from is that he was, you know, a very well-educated person who became a speechwriter for Richard Nixon.
Right.
That led to him meeting Bill Sapphire, and that led to him meeting casting people, which led to him meeting John Hughes, who heard his voice and saw his face and said, "I want you to play a teacher in this movie." This is his first thing.
This is how influential this movie was. People may not grasp it, but in the 1980s, this film was insanely influential. I would argue it's the pinnacle of John Hughes and his influence, rather, this film's influence. And this moment is just a couple of scenes with Ben Stein doing really, literally almost nothing. Yet it was enough to establish Ben Stein as a face and as a name for people to remember, all the point where he's doing game shows. And of course, now he's a political speaker and all that. But like, he had a show called Win Ben Stein's Money. Yep. That is how successful he got off of this movie. It wasn't anything else but this movie.
It literally made his career.
Yep, of course.
And right now, all he's doing is reading names, of which there are many, many A's, because we have to spend a while to get to Bueller. And whatever we might think of Ben Stein, and he's not really my favorite person in many ways, the flatness of his voice is magically hilarious in this scene.
Well, that's why I think this film works so well, because it is doing commentary without putting a neon sign over it, right? You're seeing all the kids reacting to their names being called. You know, compare this to the Key and Peele scene where he is messing up all the kids' names as he's writing the attendance down. This is the different approach. He is legitimately so kind of lost in himself. And who hasn't had these boring ass teachers who there and just kind of don't understand how much of a drone they are, but you've got to pay attention. You've got to try not to fall asleep. You've got to write down the notes so you can pass the class. But you see all the different kids. It's a great snapshot of 80s high school. All these different looking kids chiming in different ways to Ben as he's calling their names.
And this is so my high school. I mean, it really is.
There's a lot of people high school in the 1980s, yeah.
And of course, when he gets to Bueller.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
We just have that shot of the empty chair. And then there is Simone, this blonde student, who's going to say what she thinks happened to Bueller, here's how this came about, which I actually think is interesting.
Yeah.
She was not cast in this part. She was actually cast to play the girl that talks to Ferris on the payphone.
Oh, I could see that. Yeah.
But they're in Chicago shooting in the school there, which actually it's the same school they shot Breakfast Club.
Right.
And John Hughes goes, you know what? I should really shoot this, the payphone scene here. I found a good payphone. We should just do it here.
Yeah.
And the Ben Stein scene is in Los Angeles. And so he calls up this this actress and says, listen, I'm sorry, I already shot your part with another actor. And she goes, oh, that's okay. He's like, but I decided to write you another part. And so he wrote this just to make up for not casting her in the thing that he originally cast her in.
Yeah.
My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who saw Ferris pass out at 31 Flavors last night. I guess it's pretty serious.
And you know who this is?
Who is it?
Christy Swanson.
Oh, my God.
The original Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
That's funny.
And also someone now who's in Ben Stein's camp in terms of her points of views on life. Yes, very, very loudly so on social media. So very interesting film for this kind of situation. But yeah, that's Christy Swanson in one of her first roles.
And then we cut to Cameron's house.
Mm. Oh, so good.
First of all, I mean, this is a famous piece of architecture. It's in Highland Park outside of Chicago. It's designed by students of Mies van der Rohe. The guy who owned it actually did have a collection of Ferraris.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it's such a stunning location. Mm. And we hear the phone ringing and we see these fingers reach out to answer the phone from under the covers. Those are John Hughes's fingers. He did not think that Alan Ruck was being dramatic enough. So he did it himself.
What is it with these directors wanting to use their own hands?
Well, I don't think this one is quite as egregious as choking somebody.
Yeah, but, no, I agree. Yeah, yeah.
Look, as you know, hand acting is a very specific specialty.
Ask Costanza. He knows.
Hello?
Cameron, babe, what's happening?
Very little.
I love that we see Cameron in his bed. The covers are tucked in almost to look like he's in a sarcophagus, you know?
Yeah.
And we see there's medicines everywhere. And then again, this is just a great line.
Is your mother in the room?
She's in Decatur. Unfortunately, she's not staying.
Right from that, we get a sense of Cameron's life.
Yes, yes.
So Alan Ruck was in the Broadway show that Matthew Broderick was in before they started shooting Ferris Bueller's.
Wow.
And that is Biloxi Blues.
That's great.
Alan Ruck had also auditioned for the Bender part in Breakfast Club. So he'd met John Hughes.
Okay.
And so they were buddies. And as soon as he came into audition, his first audition was with Matthew Broderick. And they had massive chemistry right away because they'd been on Broadway together for months.
Of course.
And the thing that he found out was that Emilio Estevez had just passed on this movie, on playing Cameron.
Wow.
And so every time Alan Ruck sees Emilio Estevez, he thanks him. He's so good in this movie.
Oh, he's great. Oh, my God. And he's as essential as Janie is with her. Jeannie is with her energy. You have to have someone that is the complete yin to the yang of Ferris Bueller. And that is where Cameron comes in. And he is perfect. You know,
he's great in the serious parts. He's super funny in the funny parts.
Yeah.
He's completely his own kind of character. And he is one of those people who I know he's on Succession now and doing great. Okay. But I always was sad that he didn't have that career after this movie. You know, he had stuff.
Well, sure. He was in Spin City. He was all those.
Oh, that's right.
You mean theatrically. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, I expected this to be another one of those teen stars or not.
Oh, really? You thought, okay. He had such an unusual face. I guess I never expected that for him, but TV, he's been great on the small screen.
That's
of course
true.
In Generations, a small role in Generations.
And the contrast between Alan Ruck in his bed and Ferris Bueller with the tiki drink sitting by the pool is just amazing.
Is this where you start to turn on Ferris? Is this the moment where you start when he's
intimidating?
You said he's not a good person. That's what you led with. That's what you said.
No, here's what's no here. Let me see if I express myself better. I never
rewind the tape. Someone rewind the tape.
Can we get the evidence here? Yes. I never turn on Ferris. I love Ferris.
Oh, you love Ferris.
I do. I just thinking about it, I'm like, This is a spoiled kid who always gets what he wants and is perfectly happy to manipulate his friends and everybody else into not necessarily great situations in order to continue to get what he wants.
Okay.
You know, what part of that is not true?
We'll revisit it situation by situation as we go along. I think that's a smarter thing. Go ahead.
So Cameron is complaining about being sick and he can't come out, and Ferris is pressuring him to come out, and Cameron hangs up on him and says,
"Dying."
And then the phone rings and he answers it, and we hear,
"You're not dying. You just can't think of anything good to do."
So there are several fan theories about Ferris Bueller's day off.
Yeah.
One of which is that Ferris Bueller is living Groundhog Day, and that is why he is able to perfectly predict everything that happens and deal with every situation so perfectly, because in fact he has relived this day over and over again, and that is why he knows that Cameron just said, "I'm dying," so he can call him and say, "You're not dying."
The fan theory I subscribe to is that after he hangs up the phone, Cameron falls asleep without knowing it, and the rest of the film is a dream. And that it's all from Cameron's point of view. Everything that happens is, that's why he knows that he's going to call him back up and go, "You know, you're not sick. You just can't, or you're not dying. You just can't think of what to do." Right. And it all leads to Cameron getting the monologue.
Yeah.
And Cameron getting that moment of, you know, the arc. There's not really an arc for Ferris, really, but there is an arc for Cameron.
Absolutely.
And so to me, I kind of like that theory that after the first call, because we've all been really, really tired when we just kind of fall asleep knowing we're asleep. And I think he falls asleep. Plus he's drugged up with we see all those drugs. So how much of this stuff is, you know, induced by the drugs and the combination of stuff that he's going through. So I kind of like that theory. And I watched the movie this time around through that prism. And I think I agree with it, to be honest with you.
Well, you said something when we did Breakfast Club that I remember, which is, you said this is all a fantasy, or at a certain point it all becomes a fantasy because it goes to such crazy places.
Yeah. And as I was watching it this time, it actually worked in my mind of some of these jumps in logic that you see in the film.
I mean, what happens in this movie is nuts. I think this is this might not be written as a fantasy of these characters, but this movie is a fantasy.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
Like, the other fan theory, by the way, is that this is Fight Club and that Ferris Bueller is Tyler Durden. He does not exist.
Oh, that's a good one.
He's a figment of Cameron's imagination, and it's his alter ego of who he wants to be.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I actually like that idea a lot. I might need to watch this movie again through that prism. I like that idea.
Well, and that Sloane is Helena Bonham Carter.
Right. Right.
That this is actually his girlfriend who doesn't know he has a split personality. And then we have this moment, which Karen and I have sung our entire time we've known each other, of
when Cameron was in Egypt's land, let my Cameron go.
And I love that the chorus joins in with him on this.
Yes, the great little moment. And once again, the genius of John Hughes being able to slide little moments like that in all of his films that kind of add a little more to the viewer as they're watching it.
And then we have a conversation between Ferris's mom and the principal of his high school, Jeffrey Jones.
Are you also aware, Mrs. Bueller, that Ferris does not have what we consider to be an exemplary attendance record?
Very, certainly now we have to kind of bring that up as he's first presence, but certainly a very, how can I say this, uncomfortable situation with Jeffrey Jones and what happened to him and what he was involved in, and certainly all of the stuff that, and I ran into him one time at a Gelson's.
Oh yeah.
It was a weird moment because it was right when all that shit had blown up about him. And for those of you who don't know, he was caught with child pornography and there was a big old controversy around it. And I remember seeing, he looked just absolutely wrecked. And I didn't even know, because I mean, I love this movie so much. I had such a weird reaction that moment, and I just kind of froze and walked away, turned around and walked away, you know. But he's so great in the film, and it's heartbreaking to see what happened afterwards, man.
It really is. He's fantastic in Amadeus. He's amazing. I think he's amazing in this movie.
Yeah, I agree.
I think he's great.
If Ferris thinks that he can just coast through this month and still graduate, he is sorely mistaken.
And then while he's having this conversation with Ferris's mom, we cut to Grace.
The great Edie McClurg, man. She's so damn good. Do you know she's a twin?
I did not know that.
Yes, she's a twin. There's a twin. So just kind of crazy. And there's a lot of rumors that we talked about this in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, that she is the sister of the woman, the travel agent.
You did mention that.
Which is, if you think about that, that kind of actually works. So.
She's so funny in this. And it was her idea to do that big bubble hairdo. And so she did that before coming to set.
Yeah.
Without even talking to John Hughes about it. He walked in, John Hughes looked at it, goes, I love it. And then turns to her and says, how many pencils do you think you could hide in that hair? And she goes, I don't know. Let's find out. And the answer was 4. Wow. And that's when we see this little bit of her pulling all these pencils out of her hair.
She's so good.
She's great.
So far this semester, he has been absent 9 times.
9 times?
9 times.
9 times.
Do you want to know why John Hughes picked the number 9?
Wait, is it the Beatles thing?
It's the Beatles. He's a huge Beatles fan.
Of course.
And it is fun. You know, it's funny that there's certain sounds are funny. So 9 times is funny, where, you know, 7 times wouldn't have been.
Not 6-minute abs, 7-minute abs.
7-minute abs. And of course, we see the 9 times on the computer. And then as he's talking to mom, the absences go down to 2 times.
Yeah.
I asked for a car. I got a computer. How's that for being born under a bad sign?
See, again, his issue of the car.
It is his one main issue.
Yep.
By the way, does this make you think about War Games?
That he was using it. I wonder if it was a bit of a meta thing to have him using the computer in that way.
Because I saw War Games so many times before seeing this movie.
Yeah.
I can appreciate how this time of year children are prone to taking the day off. However, in Ferris's case, I can assure you he is truly a very sick boy.
Cut to Ferris with the clarinet.
Never had one lesson.
Great God.
That was just some set dressing that was sitting in the set. And Matthew Broderick said, hey, I have an idea.
That's great. Not one lesson.
So all that Ben Stein was hired to do was to read the names for the attendance scene. That was it.
Oh, wow.
And John Hughes liked it so much that he said, hey, could you teach a class? Let's have you teach a class.
Right.
And Ben Stein goes, okay, what do I teach? And John Hughes basically goes, I don't know, make something up. What do you know about? Well, Ben Stein has like a degree in economics.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is all an improv.
This is great. This is such a great lesson that he's teaching, because everything he's saying is 100% true.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like you get a mini lesson in this movie as you're watching this lecture from Ben Stein for a few seconds.
And for a guy who's not an actor,
mm-hmm.
his use of the word anyone, like how he does, like he even does it like mid-sentence a couple of times.
The Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which anyone raised or lowered, raised tariffs.
And the intercutting with the faces of those students, the bored faces.
Yeah.
Perfect.
The dude slobbering on the desk. But this is a great point of view from the teacher's point of view in that, you know what? I've just got to power through this lesson.
Yep.
And if you're not going to pay attention, you're not going to pay attention. You'll fail the test, whatever. I've got to power through the lesson, you know? So, yeah.
Well, and it's so the disconnect between where the students are and where the teachers are.
Yeah.
And like, this is where I go, the movie totally supports why Ferris Bueller is taking a day off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's nothing here for him, you know?
Yeah.
And so what happened after Ben Stein does this monologue mm-hmm. that he made up, the entire class bursts into applause, according to Ben Stein. And the crew bursts into applause. And he says, and again, according to Ben Stein, he at first thought that it was because they really enjoyed his lecture on economics and then realized that they just thought it was really, really funny. And Ben Stein describes this as the happiest day of his entire life.
Wow.
That's what he says.
Wow. Okay.
And we cut from voodoo economics to... to Ferris dancing to I Dream of Jeannie.
Good moves there. Good moves. Yep.
By the way, one of the things John Hughes wanted to make sure of in this opening sequence is that Ferris Bueller is in a different outfit every time you see him.
Yeah, of course. It sounds about right.
And we cut from the song I Dream of Jeannie to Jeannie.
Yes, right.
Walking through the hall where people are sympathizing with her about her brother.
What are you sorry for? I have to live with a trouser snake.
No, I mean, I heard he's really sick.
Whoa, who said he's sick?
A bunch of people. They said he's like on the verge of death.
By the way, all the kids at high school, they're all real high school kids.
Oh, wow. That's so smart.
And part of what he wanted was because I think Jennifer Grey and Matthew Broderick were both like 21 when they shot this. Alan Ruck's 29.
Wow.
They wanted kind of this distance a little bit between them and the real high school kids.
Right.
This guy in my biology class said that if Ferris dies, he's giving his eyes to Stevie Wonder.
So great. So great.
And these freshmen, which who really are high school freshmen, are calling Ferris on the payphone where he is playing his, in addition to having his nice computer, he has a very fancy keyboard where he's playing sick noises.
I can sense your bitterness in your voice. Yeah. He's playing these little sound cues for the two freshmen. I love the guy going, oh yeah, Ferris is getting me out of summer school. Man, I hope he doesn't die. I can't do summer school, man. I can't do And then you see the interactions between a young girl in high school and the dudes who are trying to like touch her and stuff. And she's like, get off me. And, but, you know, she has the back and forth with Ferris.
Think you'll be alive this weekend?
Yeah, I'd say I will.
Great. Maybe I'll see ya. Bye.
That's high school for you.
Yep. I love the little bit where he plays, you know, the waltz on the on his keyboard with sick sounds.
Yeah.
It's all funny. Ed Rooney says,
I don't trust this kid any further than I can throw him.
Well, with your bad knee, Ed, you shouldn't throw anybody.
Every little bit between the two of them, I think, is funny.
Yeah, it is.
And what's interesting to me is this is, it's not that Ed Rooney is the same character as what's his name in Breakfast Club, the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
But there's definitely a similar dynamic of he sees Ferris as a threat to him.
Sure.
Because he's turning these other kids against him.
They both represent the institution.
Yep.
So, yeah.
He jeopardizes my ability to effectively govern this student body.
Well, makes you look like an ass is what he does, Ed.
So we were watching this with Jax. He screamed. He cracked up so loud at that line. Mm-hmm. And Grace says, and this was her audition, by the way.
Oh, well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, dickheads. They all adore him.
And then she says, and this was an improv in the audition.
They think he's a righteous dude.
That's what got her the part.
Oh, really? So smart. Yeah. So smart.
Well, and it's that accent. That accent was her idea, too.
That is why I have got to catch him this time. To show these kids that the example he sets is a first-class ticket to nowhere.
Oh, Ed, you sounded like Dirty Harry just then.
And then Jeffrey Jones says, really, and then gives this long look.
Yeah.
What's going on in that look? I have a theory.
I think she knows. How can I say this? Because it occurred to me as I was watching it this time around. I think this is all an act from her. And that she knows how to play Rooney like a fiddle. Like most women know how to play men like a fiddle because we're idiots. She says, she absolutely appeals to his manhood by saying that Dirty Harry line. And he gives her a look like, oh, that's cool. I like that. I like that feeling, you know? So that's what I think.
I totally agree because I think Grace does this amazing thing of completely insulting and belittling him.
Yes.
In ways that he can't quite catch her. Mm-hmm. Like you shouldn't throw anyone with your bad knees, all that kind of stuff, or makes you look like an ass.
Yeah.
But then she reverses that by these little lines about Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
But then I also think, Jeffrey Jones's beat work is he was contemplating saying another tough line. Like he was about to say, go ahead, make my day.
Right.
But then changed his mind and thought better of it. That's what I see in that pause.
I could see that. Yeah.
So we're back to, him trying to convince Cameron.
Cameron, this is my 9th sick day. If I get caught, I won't graduate. I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing it for you.
Is he doing it for Cameron?
That's a good question. Maybe.
I think he cares about Cameron.
Of course he cares about Cameron, but I don't think we have enough context right? To know what their relationship was like before. Although we do hear later on in the film, at this point, we don't have enough context, but later on in the film, he says, like, you've been saying that to me since the fifth grade or whatever, third grade. And so clearly there's a history between them, but we don't know what his actual ulterior motive is here because everything he's flying by the seat of his pants the whole time in this film. So we don't know what his motive overall. So it could be Cameron, but yeah, I agree with you. It's definitely about what he wants to do as well.
Yeah, I think, well, this is, I know you think I'm insane, but this is actually relates to McMurphy in Cuckoo's Nest.
Here we go.
This,
all right.
But this is what, this. In fact, this was your thought, which I totally agree with.
Okay.
Which is that McMurphy is, in fact, just doing, he's following his own desires, and mm-hmm. that is bringing all of these other people on this journey along with him. And he does care about them, but he cares about McMurphy first.
Yes, 100%. Yeah.
I think that's true of Ferris Bueller. I think he is following his own pleasure.
Yes.
And he does care about Cameron and Sloan. Absolutely.
Right.
But he's doing what he wants to do.
Yeah. But I also think both Cameron and Sloan have their moment to kind of call him out on that because he thinks
I agree.
He's got the upper hand on both of them, but he doesn't.
I'm so disappointed in Cameron. $20 says he's sitting in his car debating about whether or not he should go out.
Cut to in his car.
He'll keep calling. He'll keep calling.
Everything Alan Ruck does.
I'll go. It's so fantastic. Yeah.
This is ridiculous. Okay. I'll go. Shit.
I've never asked you this question. I have no evidence of this, but I am certain that you have hit the passenger seat of a car.
God damn it.
In that way at some point in your life.
Oh, probably. Yeah. Either because of something that spilled on me or getting cut off in traffic, but I've hit my steering wheel much more than I've hit my passenger seat for sure. But yeah, but hit that whole thing sitting there in a car. I have done that on a few occasions for sure. When I've been on the fence about doing something, you know, cause I'm very big about sliding doors in my life. I'm a massive person who spends way too much time thinking, well, if I'm hesitant about something, I sit there and go, well, if I do this, this changes the course of my life. If I make this decision, I go and do this thing, what is it going to lead to? And if I don't go, what is it going to lead to? So I'm always that. So that sitting in the car thing I have done numerous times, man.
And then he starts the car and then he stops the car. And yeah. Then he screams. He gets out and he walks away. And the fact that John Hughes stays on the shot of the empty car and seeing him in the background. And by the way, he's wearing a Gordie Howe jersey.
Yep.
Because John Hughes is a big hockey fan.
Yeah.
There's so much in this movie that is just John Hughes paying tribute to the things that he loves.
Right. Right.
And then we cut to another classroom and the teacher, I never knew this. The teacher of the second classroom, that's Del Close.
Yes. From the Untouchables. And also a very big teacher.
Huge improv guy.
Improv. Yeah.
Yeah. We see Sloan for the first time and we see a nurse who's walking. And I think you already kind of know about what's about to happen just from watching Sloan's reaction to the nurse entering the classroom.
Yeah.
And this is Mia Sara.
Yeah.
Apparently, Molly Ringwald asked John Hughes, said that she wanted to play this part.
I don't think it would have worked.
He turned her down. He said, this part is too small for you. You can't play this part.
Yeah.
John Hughes wanted an actress that was a little bit older because he wanted someone that seemed very grounded and elegant.
Yeah.
And he auditioned Mia Sara and really liked her and then found out that she had literally just graduated from high school. And then went, well, maybe I shouldn't cast her, but realized that she was the right person. And she's one of those people, I think she's really good.
She's fantastic.
But doesn't have a huge career after this.
No. And so for her, I had more of the disappointment that she didn't go on and do more than Alan Ruck, because she's beautiful in this movie and she's got all the tools that you would need, you would imagine, to go to the next level and consistently carve out a career, you know. But I mean, the 80s are full. Like, Phoebe Cates should have been way bigger than she was. So, and who knew Jennifer Jason Leigh was going to be the one to come out of that movie to be this phenomenal star or incredible actress. So you just never know.
Yep. She's also, by the way, in one of my favorite guilty pleasure movies that I've mentioned many times on this show, which is By the Sword with F. Murray Abraham and Eric Roberts. She's in that weird fencing movie.
She's also in the best Van Damme movie, This Side of JCVD, which is Time Cop. She's his wife in Time Cop. Yeah.
What a strange career, man. And what's such good acting and what's such good directing is that when she sees the nurse, she starts to get ready to go because she already knows what's happening.
Yep.
And then her acting surprised when they call her name.
Your father called. Your grandmother has just passed.
The little catch of the breath is so great to play it. And of course, the actress who played the nurse, who worked for quite a long time, she's fantastic. Her hugging Sloane and stuff was really sweet. So,
cut to Ed Rooney.
Dead grandmother.
And he asked for her father's phone number, Mr. Peterson's phone number.
And also because he's asking, because he wants to know who Sloane is dating, because he is like a detective. You're a mini detective. Yep. You're putting the clues together.
This is George Peterson.
Please hold. How do you know it's Mr. Peterson?
And we hear this voice come over the phone.
This is George Peterson.
How are you today, sir?
Well, we've had a bit of bad luck this morning, as you may have heard.
So, spoiler alert, this is Cameron doing a fake voice.
Yeah.
Would you like to know where this voice comes from?
Oh, please.
This is the voice of Gene Sachs, the director of Biloxi Blues.
Oh.
And that Matthew Broderick and Alan Ruck used to jokingly imitate him all the time as they're making that play.
This is George Peterson, goddammit. Oh, my God. Oh,
you do it good.
I can't even imagine. Stage left.
So if you wouldn't mind excusing Sloane, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. No, I'd be happy to. Yeah, you just produce a corpse and I'll release Sloane.
It's great back and forth. And Edie McClurg makes the scene by the slow turn of just like, what the fuck is going on?
It's all right, Grace. It's Ferris Bueller, little twerp. I'm going to set a trap and let him fall right into it.
And then the phone rings and Grace picks it up.
Ed Rooney's office.
Hi, this is Ferris Bueller. Can I speak to Mr. Rooney, please?
At which point, Rooney is saying,
I'll tell you what, dipshit. You don't like my policies. You can just come on down here and smooch my big old white butt.
What I love about Rooney and what Jeffrey Jones does is that he's so bad at all this.
Yes.
Like, you could see him come up with, I'm going to say this cool thing to cut this kid down.
Right.
And it's all so just off and awkward.
Well, and this is so fun because for those of you who are younger, this is how school was back then. Like, you guys who are getting away with convincing your teachers to give you different grades, or your parents going after you, teachers going after principals, that is not how it was in the 1980s. No. For a majority of us. So I have a feeling Ed Rooney has used these tactics to success with other people, but his greatest foe, his white whale, is Ferris Bueller. And so these things that look weird because we're in the context of Ferris Bueller and look pathetic, they were effective in other kids' stories at that high school, I'm sure. So this is the thing that when I watch the movie that is so fun to explore when you put it in the context of that. He doesn't just default to this because he feels like it or he has no other option. This has worked for him before. He just can't get it to work on Ferris Bueller, which is frustrating the shit out of him.
One of the things that seems to be missing from my kids' school is fear. It's like we were afraid of the principal.
Yeah, they used to rule us by fear, ladies and gentlemen.
And that is not the case anymore. But the moment that Grace says,
Ferris Bueller's online too.
And there's a music sting, and the camera pushes in on Rooney. He looks down at those buttons and switches over.
Yeah.
And we hear Ferris in a very happy voice say,
Hey, Mr. Rooney, how you doing? Listen, I'm sorry to disturb you at work, but I'm not feeling very well today. And I was wondering if it might be possible for my sister to bring home any assignments for my classes that I might need.
And once again, he's in a new outfit. Now he's in a suit and tie, and he's checking his hair. And then we have the insert of the blinking button where Mr. Peterson is.
Yeah.
Mr. Peterson? No, I think I owe you an apology, sir.
Well, I should say you do.
And we cut to Cameron. And man, Alan Ruck giving this performance is so great.
So fantastic.
Well, I think you should be sorry, for Christ's sake. A family member dies and you insult me. What the hell is the matter with you anyway?
And then Grace and Rooney do this scramble to find Sloane. And this is how it came up. Basically, John Hughes kind of said, figure something out. And this was Edie's idea, which is she came up with this idea, which is like an acting exercise, which is called help hinder. Have you ever done this?
No.
This what one was this? Not. Yeah, it was not familiar to me. Yeah. And what it is it's basically that Edie is going to try to look like she's helping him, but continually getting in his way in one way or another. So it's like they're both trying to do the same thing, but all they can do is get in each other's way.
It's hilarious because she tosses the phone to Grace and runs into the other room, and he just kind of stands at the desk looking left to right, not knowing what to do, what to grab, then grabs it. And then Ferris gets on the phone, and or Peterson is talking, and she's trying to imitate his voice, which is hilarious by Edie McClure. All of that. And the thing is, when she throws the phone back at Ed, she screams, or when she waves Ed back, because that's such a great, honest reaction. She is completely out of her element, does not want to get caught doing this, and is just desperately screaming for him to come back and take the phone so she's not in this situation anymore. It is so well acted between both of them. It's so honest.
And apparently most of this business is all one take. Like, this is all the first take.
There you go.
Well, you just mind your P's and Q's, Buster, and remember who you're dealing with.
And we cut to Ferris, who says,
Bueller. Ferris Bueller.
Literally one of the coolest people on film of all time.
True. Very true. One of the coolest characters, for sure. That moment, though, what do you think about that moment? Because, like, what are we doing here? Why is he changing clothes again? He's not going to be leaving in the suit, is he?
No, it makes no sense. It's totally, I mean, well, and the thing is to do all the things that they apparently do in this day would take like 5 days.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
good point.
It goes to, you know, just what you're saying before. This is fantasy. I mean, this right. is just,
right.
He's putting on a new outfit. He's putting on a suit so he can say Bueller, Ferris Bueller in this moment. You know, that's why he's doing it.
To show off to Cameron, I guess, yeah.
I want my daughter out in front of the school in 10 minutes by herself.
And Ferris kind of hits him.
He's too suspicious. He'll think something's up. Cover it, you.
And they have this great, like, I love how Alan Ruck goes from the confident, angry Mr. Peterson
yeah.
to the totally frail and insecure Cameron instantaneously. Like,
come on.
Oh, that come on face is, he has like a perfect comedian face. Oh, you know what I mean?
Totally. It's a rubber face. It's great.
Yeah.
I changed my mind. I want you out in front of the school with her. I'd like to have a few words with you, by God.
And he knocks the phone out of his head.
On second thought, we don't have time to talk right now. We'll get together soon and we'll have lunch.
And then Ferris kicks him.
Look, don't ask me to participate in your stupid crap if you don't like the way I do it. You make me make a phony phone call to Edward Rooney? The man could squash my nuts into oblivion and then you deliberately hurt my feelings.
This is where we see, look, Cameron says this later in the film at the end, right? He says, I wouldn't have let you convince me if I didn't want to come, if I didn't want to bring the car, right? In this moment here, Cameron is standing up for himself
mm-hmm.
because it hasn't just been his dad or the principal or his mom. It's also been Ferris. And we have those situations in our lives where someone has the dominant position as a friend and essentially co-opts the kind of pseudo-fatherly role in your life, and you go to them for advice or you go to them for a back and forth. And that's what Ferris is. So his pushback on Ferris in this moment is the first shot we have across the bow that Cameron is his own person. He isn't just Ferris's friend. And when you have these side, I'm not going to say this, when you have characters that are, I don't know, like co-leads, or certainly part of a co-lead situation, it behooves you to give them their own life. And certainly with Cameron in that moment, when he pushes back and tells him that, you know, don't fucking hit me. You asked me to do this stupid shit for you, and now you're complaining that I'm doing it wrong when I had it right the whole time. And Ferris, because like you said, Ferris, the little privileged kid, he's, oh, I didn't hit you. I lightly tapped you, trying to change the narrative, trying to gaslight him a little bit about what actually happened so he doesn't have to take responsibility for his behavior, because that's not something that's in Ferris's wheelhouse right now in his life. So it's a great exchange between the two of them that adds a little more edge to their relationship than you might think in a film like this.
Now, I totally agree with that. And I think, I mean, there are times in one's life where you need to have the friend that will push you to do the thing that you maybe need and yeah. wouldn't do on your own, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a time where friends push you to do things that you shouldn't do
right.
and you need to stand up. I mean, already Ferris has pushed him into a situation that could be really bad.
Yeah.
And it's going to get a lot worse. And I like, and well, this is the thing is, I totally do think Ferris absolutely really does care about Cameron. There's no question in my mind. But the degree to which it's just what you said of him not really taking responsibility or gaslighting, that's also all part of his personality as well.
And I think Ferris doesn't have a lot of close friends. I think Ferris is beloved and well known, and everybody knows Ferris and loves Ferris. But Cameron is his friend because Cameron, just like Robin Williams with Stellan Skarsgård in Good Will Hunting, Cameron knew Ferris when he didn't know, when he was pimply faced, he didn't know what side of the bed to piss on at summer camp. That's the difference. And I think that's where we see this friendship solidified throughout the movie. But there's a reason Ferris doesn't have other friends he could call. There's other friends like he calls Cameron because Cameron has a car, yes, but also because Cameron is legitimately his only friend. You know,
that is a really interesting statement because, and I think you're right, because those high school kids that idolize him, those aren't his friends.
No, no.
I mean, to some degree, your friends need to have, I don't know how to say it. They need to have some power over you. That's not the right way to say it. But they need to, you know, it's like it has to be some equality. You can't just be the god that everyone worships. That's not friendship.
Right. Everyone else, I think, in the school is a transactional relationship with Ferris. They either stroke his ego or they need something from him. So it's a transactional relationship. Or associates, you would even say. But with Cameron, Cameron has the goods on Ferris. So there's a certain level of friendship that develops there, you know, like just because someone has gets his way all the time, you got to have someone who calls him out all the time. That's how you solidify friendship, you know.
It's an interesting question to think about. I wonder, and I, you know, well, let's readdress this when we get to the end. But
sure,
has their relationship changed by the end of the movie? You know,
oh yeah, 100%. I think 100%. But yeah,
I think so too. So after a really funny little physical bit where Rooney is running down the hallway and stopping to look calm in front of each classroom and then running and then stopping.
What a great little detail, man.
This movie is so full of those things.
Yeah, agreed.
It's then we get back to Ferris and Cameron, and Ferris, after being nice and trying to make up a little bit, says,
"You did screw up though, right? I mean, not that it was completely your fault."
He gaslights it. Dude, we know people like this, don't we, in our lives who don't want to... I mean, I'm not going to mention the person that I know and personally in my life separately from you that does this, but it is frustrating when they do it. Just sit in this place that you fucked up. Just sit in it. It's okay. We've all been there. We all get through it. But why do you have to try to minimize your blame in a situation? What is it you're getting out of it? And when I experience it, it's always frustrating. And I've learned over the last few years to push back and call that person out. But it is frustrating to be someone who wants to kind of minimize what they did so that they can achieve a certain level of equality all over again.
Well, this is why I'm saying Ferris is not always a good person. I mean, Ferris.
True.
And Cameron immediately knows Ferris is up to something and says,
right. "Why? Well, to fix the situation, I'm going to have to ask you for a small favor."
So let me ask a Steve Morris question.
Yes, I'm ready.
Did he always know he was going to ask for that Ferrari?
I've thought about this and I've gone back and forth about it. My gut is that he did. Mm-hmm. That's my gut. What about you?
Yeah, 100%. I think he knew somehow, some way in the back of his, I think he had in the back of his mind, if the opportunity presents itself, I'm going to blow this out. This is my, as you said, he can be a selfish guy. If I'm going to have this ninth day and risk graduation, I'm going to blow it all out because I'm a senior and this is the end of my high school life. So I want to have an awesome last day playing hooky before I have to go back to school and finish out the year. So to me, I think he had it in his mind that he was going to find his way, whether manipulating it or taking advantage of the opportunity when it came up, to find a way to get to that Ferrari. Did he think he was going to get it? I don't know. But I think he had it in his mind that he was going to get to that Ferrari. Because, I mean, he had Sloan record that message that Rooney calls later and gets Sloan's family, and it's Sloan leaving that message on the answering machine. So he had planned this out.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that point. That is a very good point. The whole way this is filmed is beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we start down at their feet, walking up to the glass doors, and the doors open. We hear the birds. By the way, they also considered a Porsche Turbo for this.
Ooh.
Ferrari is just That this car is so beautiful.
It's choice, you might say.
It's choice. I highly recommend picking one up if you have the means.
The 1961 Ferrari 250 GT California.
Oh Yeah by Yellow.
Less than 100 were made. My father spent 3 years restoring this car.
I bought the album from Yellow just to have this song.
Right.
There's nothing like this song.
It is his love. It is his passion. It is his fault he didn't lock the garage.
So all the inserts of the cars, the real extreme close-ups, those are off of a real Ferrari.
Oh, yeah. No surprise. Yeah.
Because they just couldn't fake it. But the rest of it is a kit. It's like a fiberglass version of it. And so whenever they're really close to it, that's where they would use these inserts.
Yeah.
Because this, even in 1985 when they filmed this, this is a really expensive car.
Yeah.
I love everything that Matthew Broderick does, the way he touches the car, the way his whole reaction to it is great.
Ferris, my father loves this car more than life itself.
A man with priorities so far out of whack doesn't deserve such a fine automobile.
You're a high school kid. What do you fucking know what a man deserves? But, you know, in that moment, he, again, like you say, he's trying to get what he wants.
Cameron, I'm sorry, but we can't pick up Sloan in your car. Mr. Rooney would never believe Mr. Peterson drives that piece of shit.
It's an insidious thing what Ferris is doing here, right? I mean, if you want to break it down psychologically, as you were talking about earlier, that Ferris is not always the best person. This is insidious because he's still trying to reclaim the dominant position in their relationship from that moment in the kitchen. From bringing him over to get the car, and then in that moment, he doesn't have to call Cameron's car a piece of shit, but he does. He knows Cameron's sensitive, but it's once again, it's his way of reclaiming a dominant position in a friendship. And so he has to undercut something that Cameron has that he doesn't have. And he does say it like, well, I have to envy your piece of shit because I don't even have anything. But he has to first insult it so that he can lay some kind of psychological claim on it or dominion over it. This is how this can be sometimes in human relationships, human interactions, you know.
Well, and let's be real clear.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I love this movie. I love everything that happens. What Ferris Bueller is doing in this moment is absolutely terrible.
Yes. This is
terrible.
Yeah.
Like, there is no way that Ferris can predict the consequences that this is going to have on his friend Cameron.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, he's stealing a fucking Ferrari. Like, this is,
well,
and it's
they're both stealing the Ferrari. Let's be real.
Sure. But it's Cameron wouldn't do this on his own. This is all Ferris pushing Cameron into doing it.
Yeah. But I think you're removing the responsibility Cameron has to have said no. And Cameron says later on at the end of the film,
absolutely,
he says, I wouldn't have let you do this if I didn't want to do it. Right. The car. So I think Cameron wanted someone to push him to do it because Cameron's been wanting to do it for a very long time.
I think that is definitely true for Cameron's character. It doesn't excuse Ferris's behavior.
No,
because Ferris is doing this because I want to drive this Ferrari.
Absolutely. 100%.
And watching him, I don't know what direction John Hughes gave to Matthew Broderick on how to get into this car, but it has always looked like someone sliding into a really hot tub to me.
Yeah.
Like just the gingerness of it. It's and the joy. It's so, so good.
How about we run a nice Cadillac? A nice stretch job with a TV and a bar. How about that?
Which, by the way, that is actually a perfectly reasonable solution.
Sure.
In fact, it's a better solution because they have a death in the family and they might be, you know, a limo makes sense in a way a Ferrari does not.
How many kids you know that could order a limo?
Well, these are rich kids, man.
Yeah, but still, man.
I mean, I don't know how much
it's the age thing, right? You can't.
Clearly Cameron's family is very rich.
Yes, but like you to rent a car, you have to be 25. So to rent a limo, I imagine you need your parents' permission if you're a teenager. So I don't think you could have rented the limo.
Wait, you're saying, I mean, this movie is realistic now?
I'm just trying to work within the logic, I guess, of what might be here. But yeah.
And I love the shot of Matthew Broderick backing up into frame. It's just.
Oh, yeah. So good.
I mean, this was one of the interesting things, particularly with this movie about John Hughes, is we don't think of John Hughes as a brilliant camera person or things like that. The shots are great. It's a really well put together movie.
Yeah, he to me, John Hughes gets a little bit disrespected because people love the nostalgia of his films, but they don't actually take the time to really understand how brilliant of a filmmaker he was in these movies. Other filmmakers tried to make teenage films that connected to teenagers back in the 1980s. There's a reason when you say that name to certain people from that time, it elicits such a response, and it's because of his direction. It isn't just the writing or the interactions of the actors or the casting. It's the direction as well. The smart moves that he makes that appeals to us on a molecular level when we're watching his movies. They just spoke to us from our core out, you know?
Absolutely. And the thing is, and we talked about this, I know, when we did Breakfast Club, is that the ability to look back at what life was really like when you were in high school and give it truth is something that most writers can't do.
Yeah.
And he can. And his batting average is, as you listed his films, is really, really high.
Yes.
We're back with Rooney and Sloan, and I love his words of wisdom.
Put wisdom in quotation marks, but
they're
yes.
They're all just so, I am trying to look like a wise, sensitive man so that you say nice things to your dad when you see him. And then we hear the car coming, we see a bus pass by, and then there is the Ferrari with Matthew Broderick standing in front in a hat and a trench coat. And she goes to her dad.
Hi.
Do you have a kiss for daddy?
Are you kidding?
And they make out as Rooney watches.
So that's how it is in their family.
So he doesn't suspect anything just yet. And it's a weird thing to be casual about a father and daughter making out, but it's an interesting comment. Of course, the 80s were a weird time for that. You know, you could have your mom try to hit on you back in the 1950s, and you could have brother and sister kiss in Star Wars. So the 80s were really weird about that. Or a big, you're sleeping with an 11-year-old in a human body, in an adult body. So we were weird about that kind of stuff. But in that moment, you know, nowadays you'd have some people who might have an issue with that. But in that moment, it's a funny moment. And it isn't until they get in the car and speed off that I think Ed realizes he's been had.
Well, the fact is Ferris's voice sounds nothing like the Mr. Peterson that he talked to on the phone.
That's true.
The other thing, by the way, is that kiss, it was really a short kiss. It was romantic, but it was short, but it was extended in post to make it look like a really long kiss.
That makes sense, yeah.
What are we going to do?
The question isn't what are we going to do. The question is what aren't we going to do?
Don't say we're not going to take the car home. Please don't say we're not going to take the car home.
And again, it's the takes to the camera, breaking the fourth wall that Matthew Broderick is so good at. He turns right to us and says,
if you had access to a car like this, would you take it back right away? Neither would I.
And speeds out of frame. So Matthew Broderick's been cast. Alan Ruck and Mia Sara think that they've been cast. And they go in for a wardrobe test, which a wardrobe test, theoretically, is you just put characters in costume and you film them to see how everything looks.
Yeah.
And the wardrobe test gets shot and it goes to some executives, and the executives watch it and they come out and tell Alan Ruck and Mia Sara, I'm sorry, there's just no chemistry with you and Matthew Broderick.
Oh, shit.
And so the executives call up John Hughes and say, okay, I think we're going to have to recast. And John Hughes is like, it was a wardrobe test. They weren't acting. They were just standing there.
Oh, executives.
Yeah. So this is really where you see John Hughes' love of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Because to the song Beat City by the Flower Pot Man, and we should say this is a great soundtrack.
It is a great soundtrack. Agreed. This soundtrack woke me up to the Smiths, which we'll get to later. Yeah.
And we see just beautiful shots of the skyline. And I actually think this sequence of them driving is almost a nice little rest because things have been moving really, really fast up to this point.
Yeah.
And Ferris starts letting go of the steering wheel to mess with Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just think, dude, it's a multi-$100,000 Ferrari. He's like, keep your hands on the fucking wheel, man.
Jesus. Well, and look, once again, a little window into their relationship. Cameron slaps him on the top of the head. So again, he's got a limit to what he'll let Ferris do, you know?
And then we cut to someone passing a Pepsi can around and saying, save Ferris.
What?
See, we're collecting money to buy Ferris Bueller a new kidney. They run about 50 G's or so. So if you could help out.
Go piss up a flagpole.
There used to be Save Ferris shirts that everybody wore for years, man. Until the Vote for Pedro shirts came out, Pedro shirts came out. Those, you know, sometimes I have to, you know, remember to say it in the Spanish accent. But yeah, the Save Ferris shirts were great. Oh my God, I loved seeing those, man. But the situation with the Pepsi, right? The asking for money and all of that, it's right up on Genie, and Genie is like super mad at the dude and slaps the Pepsi can of coins out of his hand.
Hey!
By the way, how is he going to collect enough money for a kidney, 50 grand with a Pepsi can? But that's how you are in high school, I guess, for some people. When she slaps the can out, his response is hilarious.
And what if you need a favor someday from Ferris Bueller? Then where'll you be, huh? You heartless wench.
I didn't grow up in the 70s as a teenager. So Jane, you ignorant slut, was never a thing in my mind, like a thing I would say. But you heartless wench was something that would always come up in certain moments as a funny retort in my mind for something that happened. So it was so funny to see it again in the film.
You know, it'd be interesting to, like, I don't know how you would do this, but to find out, depending on what year you graduated high school or what generation you are, what is your most quotable movie? Like, what were the movies that everyone of your era quoting?
This is up there. I mean, like I said.
Oh, yeah.
Then they walked over and was like, are you doing the whole movie for me? Because I swear to God, I just know them backwards and forwards.
Yep.
This is up there for sure.
Ferris Bueller's behind this. There is no doubt in my mind. And now he's got Sloane Peterson involved in this thing.
Her grandmother, too.
So smart.
She's so funny.
15 years from now, when he looks back on the ruin his life's become, he is going to remember Edward Rooney.
So there's all the stuff with Paul Gleason and Bender, and where he has a whole monologue about 10 years from now when you've forgotten about this place. Or he has the whole thing about... Imagine John Bender in 10 years. That's the same kind of stuff that's going on with Rooney.
Right. Each of their main antagonists gets that retort said to them. That's a great point. Yeah.
Well, and again, this is the institution the representatives of the institution feeling disrespected by the kids.
Yeah.
You know, are we pull our Ferrari into a garage? By the way, I love like the berets and the outfit. You know, it's just such 80s, 80s clothes.
We're not leaving the car here.
Why not?
It could get wrecked, stolen, scratched, breathed on wrong. A pigeon could shit on it. Who knows?
And Ferris goes, calm down. I'm going to give the guy a fiver.
A fiver. High school kids, man.
And up walks Richard Edson.
Pedo.
He has such a perfect face for this part. You know,
this whole interaction, dude. He's like his slow clocking in, and then the quick flash of like, damn, that's a nice car.
Yeah,
maybe the nicest car he's ever had in that garage. And when he walks over, and Ferris is like, "Do you speak English?" His fucking reaction, which is a racist line, by the way.
And I know.
And he says to him, he says, "What kind of country do you think we're in?" And throwing back at him the stupidity of that question. Ferris sneaks off a look at the camera, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting moment. And then he gets in that, and then he has to coax Cameron out of the car. So this whole interaction with this guy is so fascinating, man.
This is where it's like, on the one hand, Ferris is like the coolest guy in the world.
Sure.
On the other hand, he is a rich, privileged kid who doesn't know much about the world at all.
Not at all. Right, exactly.
And his sense of entitlement is exceptionally high.
Yeah. You fellas have nothing to worry about. I'm a professional.
Professional what?
Drives the car away.
Yeah.
Ferris is all proud of what he did with his Fitzy. And they walk out on the street. And the minute they walk out on the street, right behind them, that car pulls out and his buddy jumps in.
By the way, I don't know if you know this, Steve, but and maybe you did the research for this, but they are talking about doing a sequel to this movie and that it is going to focus on those two guys.
I did not know that.
I don't know how that makes any sense, but they're talking about doing a sequel and it would be those two guys and their adventures. And it would be somewhat loosely related to Ferris or connected to the world of Ferris Bueller, right? Of course, those guys are older now. I think they're both still alive. So it would be fascinating, or they're going to recast maybe and explore what happens to them on those in that car on that day.
Well, we know they travel around 200 miles.
Yes. So what happened in those 200 miles could be a separate Ferris Bueller movie, but it's a different person's name, one of those guys' name, or they're both their names, in essence, and what happened over those 200 miles.
Okay. Well, in 2035, I expect to do this film on the Cinephiles.
Well, I hope not. But listen, and I don't think it's going to be good is what I'm saying. But it's fascinating, too, because this is a film about these guys, these kids playing hooky from school, teenagers playing hooky from school. Those two dudes jump in the car and 200 miles, they essentially played hooky from their job.
Totally. No, absolutely. It's absolutely
those
true.
Are companion pieces if you want to do a sequel. So
we have a sequence where mom comes home and it's all scary music and she opens the door and we see that there's a mannequin in the bed with a very dark arm that's clearly visible.
Yeah.
And that there's snoring going on from his synthesizer, and she opens and that there's a trophy from a string that when she opens the door causes the mannequin to turn away from her.
Yeah.
But needless to say, Ferris gets away from it. And then we cut to them. And this is John Hughes' love letter to Chicago, because we're at the Sears Tower on the observation deck. And I love the shots up at their faces. It's just well shot. And I don't know why it's funny that Cameron says,
"I think I see my dad."
You know, we go to the stock market, the commodities exchange, I think, and watch all the people doing their strange hand gestures. And then we watch Alan Ruck do just fantastic hand gestures.
Oh, yeah. Very funny stuff.
And Ferris turns to Sloan and says,
"You want to get married?"
"Sure.
Today." "I'm serious."
This is Ferris once again, like, let's do the crazy things, right? Without thinking of the consequences. And Cameron and Sloan are always thinking of the consequences. And in this moment, Sloan is the one that says to him, like, "I don't want to get married today." She makes it clear. And it's kind of mind-blowing that you tell me that she had just graduated high school, because she is clearly much more composed than Matthew Broderick. Because of the character that he's doing, but right, she has this energy that feels older than Matthew Broderick in this exchange. And so this is, once again, like I said, Sloan and Cameron have a way of pushing back on Ferris or being aware of what Ferris is and their time. Like, I don't think she ever marries Ferris. I think Ferris was a building block in her life and a great experience for what it was, but she outgrew Ferris for sure.
Yeah,
and so this moment is, I think, you're seeing the beginning of the dissolving of this relationship, this moment, even though he's asking to marry her.
First of all, I'm really glad, because I totally agree with you that this relationship will not continue.
No,
like, of course. This relationship now. I have a very negative interpretation. I'm not saying that this is what I'm about to say is true, but it's a thought that pops in my mind.
Okay.
Is that I've known people that sometimes will say the thing that they know is going to make you feel really good about them or feel something positive, knowing that you're going to say no to it. You know what I mean?
Right. They use the situation to, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think Ferris knows she's going to say no to getting married today. Mm-hmm. And that makes him free to say the romantic thing that he knows is going to make her feel romantic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, because there's a built-in out. But probably the real reason, I think John Hughes said this, that this scene exists, is to have the Cameron moment.
"Give me one good reason. Why not?"
"I'll give you two good reasons why not. My mother and my father, they're married and they hate each other. You've seen them, am I right?"
"So what?"
"Well, it's like that car. He loves the car. He hates his wife."
So let me ask the question back to you. Why does he think that relates to Ferris and Sloan? Does he think that Ferris loves his life like the Ferrari, but doesn't love Sloan, or would end up hating Sloan because Sloan would eventually want him to stop living this charmed life of his and deal with and live in the real world?
That's a really good question. The line that my brain immediately went to is the moment in Breakfast Club where Ally Sheedy says, "It's inevitable. When you grow up, your heart dies."
Mm.
Yeah. You know, is that I think Cameron's, I mean, you learn what marriage is by looking at your parents.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And I think Cameron has looked at the institution of marriage and said, that's where your heart dies, you know?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and I had to say, actually, but you make a really good point. I hadn't thought about it quite this way. Mm. Ferris just used his friend to get to drive the Ferrari.
Sure.
And Cameron just said, "My dad loves the car. He hates his wife."
Yeah.
Is that the object is more important to his father than the human.
Right.
And Ferris just used his friend to get to the object.
Yeah. when everybody hands you things and you're super popular, it's real hard to, it's a certain level of wealth. It isn't actual money wealth, but it's emotional wealth. And so it makes it harder for you to connect to people on a human level. That's what I think. Because you're so used to being feted, you don't know what it's actually like to fall down and stumble and be vulnerable and be in need. You have no concept of it. And so in a way, that can warp your mind a bit to, for lack of a better term, to see human beings as a means to an end or as something to fill your life with, rather than really at a molecular level connecting to them. And I think that's what you see with Ferris. He doesn't see that. And when we get to that Chicago, when we get to the Abe Froman scene, it's very clear in that scene how he sees people and the consequences that could befall people in his sphere because of the things that he's doing.
I couldn't agree more. And I think getting what you want and having everyone tell you you're awesome all the time, it's not good for you.
That's why I exist.
And then we head off to the fanciest restaurant in the city of Chicago, Chez Louis.
Chez Louis. Yeah.
And they walk in and Ferris checks the little reservation books and sees the name Abe Froman. And then a very snooty maitre d' played by Jonathan Schmock comes up. Here's how he got this gig. Is he was a stand-up comic and had a partner who did sketch with, and they had an idea that they got a pitch meeting with John Hughes, and John Hughes did not bite on the idea they were pitching, but said, I might have a part for you in my movie. And that's how he got this gig.
I used to watch their show.
Oh, really?
Him and his partner had a show in the 80s, or they were part of a sitcom. And I'm trying to remember what the name of the sitcom was, because they had such great chemistry as actors in the thing that they were doing. Oh, it's the Michael Nesmith Show in television parts.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
Yes. And they had a show called Double. They were in Double Trouble. They were part of the, because that was a show with Katie Sagal's sisters, Jean Sagal and Liz Sagal. Mm. They were the twins who were the leads in the show. And it was Jonathan Schmuck with another guy. I think it was James Vallely, who was his partner. And I just remember them being a part of this, almost like kind of, they were like the bosom buddies of the show. And so when he popped up in Ferris Bueller, I was like, oh, this is cool. And he does such a great job here in this scene. Oh,
he is perfectly irritatingly snooty. I mean, it's, you know, it's perfect.
May I help you? You can sure as hell try. Hi, I'm Abe Froman. Party of three for 12.
You're Abe Froman.
That's right. I'm Abe Froman.
The sausage king of Chicago.
Yeah, that's me.
That's me. All the takes are so good. And you know, the maitre d' knows that he's lying and trying to dismiss him. And he says,
are you suggesting that I'm not who I say I am?
I'm suggesting that you leave before I have to get snooty.
Snooty?
Snotty.
Snotty.
Snotty?
And at this point, Sloane and Cameron are like, okay, let's go. This is too far.
Okay, Abe, let's get on out of here.
No, we like to be seated.
Listen, young man, either you take the field trip outside or I'm going to have to call the police.
You're going to call the police on me?
Yes.
Fine. As a matter of fact, I'll call him myself.
The storytelling is so good because he looks down at the numbers on the little button on the phone and we see him dialing, and then that phone immediately rings.
Yeah, it's such an interesting scene because, you know, he tells him, if you touch me, I yell rat. Mm-hmm. So that I'd never even thought about that situation in a restaurant, but it's so brilliant to use that. And his comment to them as he's walking off, the maitre d', when he's just like, I weep for the future, you know, right. Which is the comment of every person who's above a teenager who says that sometimes when they see teenagers do things. We do it now. You know, a lot of us who are above a certain age certainly see teenagers now and go, oh, man, we're so fucked in our future. And we have that fourth wall break.
A, you can never go too far. B, if I'm going to get busted, it is not going to be by a guy like that.
So first of all, he goes to get the other phone. And we hear Sloane there asking for Abe, and she gives the description of Ferris. And here's the thing. Normally, in a movie, if you use the same gag twice to trick somebody, and that this gag being the sort of two people on the phone line, I would say you're repeating yourself. I feel the opposite in this. I don't know how you feel.
No, it's a completely different scenario, so it works. It's a completely different scenario.
Well, and you kind of, because, and I think maybe because you're a little more ahead of it this time, that you go, oh, they're using the same thing on this guy.
He uses the same voice to be the police chief. Yeah.
Well, and the same name. It's Sergeant Peterson.
Sergeant Peterson. That's right. Right. And the temptation he has to not hit the other button is so great to see him have the inner back and forth. And then he does hit the button.
Mr. Froman, this is Sergeant Peterson, Chicago Police.
And cut to them sitting down at the table.
And his eating crow in that standing there next to the table is fascinating.
I appreciate your understanding.
Don't think twice. It's understanding that makes it possible for people like us to tolerate a person like yourself.
Now, in the 1980s, when you're caught up in this film, you're on Ferris's side. But of course, as Steve was pointing out throughout the episode here, there are moments now as we've kind of changed in our mentality or our approach to films where this moment from him is a pretty dickish moment to have a rich kid talking down to a maitre d' who's probably struggling to pay his bills because you don't make that much money being a maitre d' and doing his thing and you just made a fool of him. And yet you're going to dig the knife in even deeper by saying that it allows him. Because in the 80s, you're seeing him as this snooty guy and whatever. But as you get older, you realize that guy's probably struggling to live, you know?
It's funny, when we started, you were going to have all these arguments with me. And now here you are literally making every one of my points for me. I 100% agree. Well, this is the thing, is that Ed Rooney...
I still like him.
I love him. Yeah. Look, I love the movie.
The thing I default to is he's a kid. He's a teenager. What is he?
Ed Rooney's a jerk. And this maitre d' is a snooty jerk. Mm-hmm. They're also both totally right.
Oh, no. Rooney is absolutely right. Yeah, that's the trick of the movie, is they make you go against Rooney and see him as the antagonist, when in fact he is the correct, he is the protagonist in a way, because he is trying, he is trying to achieve something, right? In films we say the antagonist, most of the time in a great film, the antagonist is trying to get something, trying to achieve something, whether it's to win the hand of a woman or to get a treasure or to get some kind of closure about something. Ed is trying to catch this guy. That's his job, to catch this guy, because this guy has made a fool of him. And he is, by the letter of the law, breaking the school code of conduct to be let go. But the manner in which he's choosing to do it is where it's an issue.
This is why the movie totally works.
Yeah.
Is watching Ed Rooney get his comeuppance is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the fact is that Ferris did break into the school's computer system to change his number of absences. Right. He did lie about a dead grandmother to get his girlfriend out. He is cutting class. He is doing everything is true. And this maitre d' is absolutely right. This is a high school kid who's come in trying to steal somebody's reservation. Right. He's totally right. Now, we feel good about the snooty jerk getting his comeuppance. But, well, and I have another question about this too, by the way. Because as they sit and they eat, did they pay for this meal or did the maitre d' compliment?
Probably not. I would imagine the restaurant took it on the chin.
And one would assume this is a fairly expensive restaurant. So now they're stealing a meal after lying and manipulating this guy. You know, and again, I love the movie. It's totally, totally fun.
But these are the joys of being young, is that you do these things without knowing what the actual ramifications are. And you like rebelling and you like... So there's a joy in seeing these scenes. You know, I don't think either one of us are trying to throw water on these scenes, but we're analyzing them as we do on the show. But the joy of those scenes are still there. And it's a lot of fun to see him get away with what he gets away with in these moments. And yes, he's very likable. So when he does dig the knife in, you're actually kind of laughing along with him as he does it. Because his face, okay, yes, thanks. The maitre d's face is so good with his reactions to it.
Well, and we love him getting nailed by Ferris, basically. Yeah. Yeah. I also think, by the way, it was very smart of John Hughes to not have them drinking wine.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Great point. Yes.
Because then we would have a weird feeling about that.
Yeah.
And he turned and all the little funny bits of chewing on the ice and all that, they're all funny. And he turns to Cameron and says,
Cameron, dear friend, you thought we wouldn't have any fun. Shame on you.
And I think at that moment, you didn't think you'd have any fun, is a good time for us to stop part one of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this film. You could visit us on Facebook. If you do a search for The Cinephiles, you can follow the show at @_files on Twitter, Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And of course, you can follow me at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, on YouTube, Stitcher, Spotify, and you can buy or stream Ferris Bueller's Day Off along with every other movie we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net. John, what do you have to tell the fine people out there?
Well, you can always follow me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, The Outlaw Nation on Twitch, and my YouTube channel, please. I'm trying to break my own record and get 25,000 subscribers by the end of the year on my YouTube channel. Come and help me do that. Double what I have now. You got to have big goals in life. So head on over to youtube.com/JohnRocaSays and see all the great content I've got going on there. And I am committed to bringing Steve Morris onto the channel more to do some of our great conversations about the things that are going on in the world and some of these movies that we're watching that are currently out.
Well, I would love that. I like Cameron. You can always call me and get me to come on over. Not that I'm saying that you act like Ferris.
Yeah, please, not what I meant.
I think that's it for this week. We'll be back to have more fun adventures with Ferris Bueller in the city of Chicago right here on The Cinephiles.